Hi, and welcome to Mind Matters, the podcast where we talk about mental health topics that affect everyday people just like you and I. I'm so happy to be your host today. My name is Wendy McCarty. I am the regional director of our four facilities here in Central Florida, including Central Florida Behavioral, University Behavioral, Palm Point, and La Amistad. Within the four facilities, we provide a full continuum of mental health and substance use care from outpatient all the way through residential levels of care. I am so happy to be here with some very special people today. My co-host, Gabe Fernandez, nice to see you.
Thank you, Wendy. It's good to be here.
And Gabe is representing Central Florida Behavioral. And then I also have to my right over here, Shaney Sloan from University Behavioral Center. Hey, Shaney.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And our guest of honor, someone who I am so honored to know and to have the privilege to have worked with and done some seminars with, Sandra Stanford. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such an honor to be here.
Aw, Sandra is a licensed mental health counselor, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about attachment today. So I'm going to have you just start out by explaining what is an attachment and why is it so important to our mental health?
I really love the attachment theory, and when I first learned about attachment, I didn't quite understand how it all worked together until I began studying it and finding out about someone named Dr. John Bowlby. And back in the early 1900s, he was intrigued by the fact that they had these bombings in London, and the parents sent their children away to be safe with people that they knew. But it didn't help the children to be away from their parents. And we began to understand that it's more than a roof over your head. It's more than someone providing a check. Like in the 60s when I was raised, if your dad went to work every day and you sat down and ate dinner together, you should be happy. You should be content. But we found out that that's not enough, that babies need nurturing, that babies need to know that when they cry, there's going to be a caring adult to come and to see what's happening with them. And so the attachment theory helps us to understand what that means. And so I am very grateful to Dr. John Bowlby.
That reminds me, I remember reading in my psychology books about the studies that they did with the babies, and they would place them, and tell me if I'm telling the story right, in cribs, and they were in orphanages, I believe.
They were.
Okay.
They were, and did not thrive. And they also did a study with monkeys. It was called Harlow's Monkeys. And they had a cage with a monkey in it, and on one side they had a monkey that was cloth. On the other side they had a wire monkey that had food.
Okay.
And the monkey would spend about 23 hours a day with the cloth monkey and only go over to the wire monkey to eat, but then go right back to the cloth monkey.
That is amazing.
So in some of my previous jobs, I've worked residential and group homes. And you could definitely tell when someone had reactive attachment disorder, how those bonds were hard for them to form and it was hard for them to receive praise.
Yes, it is hard. And the beautiful thing that I think gives people hope, people who are listening can have hope, that these attachment wounds, as we talk about it, and they go, oh, my word, that's me. I get anxious when I don't get a text sent back to me in a certain amount of time. Or I withdraw, I isolate when things are happening around me. I'm scared of intimacy. It can be healed. It can be healed. And one way that we heal an attachment wound is recently my two grandsons, they come over every Friday. And we hug on them and we kiss them. And if they're upset, we see what's happening with them. But last Friday, I had something going on and they couldn't kiss Nani two Fridays ago. And so the following Friday, they come in the door. Can we kiss you, Nani? Can we kiss you? And I said, yes, you can kiss me, not thinking about the week before. And my son-in-law comes in, and he said, all the way over here, they were saying, are we going to get to kiss Nani today?
Oh, bless her heart.
When I thought about that later, any wound in me that would have been there that would have caused some attachment issues, when I sat in that memory of them running in that door wanting to kiss Nani, that right there can bring some healing, and I make it a little bit larger in me. So one way that people can, who are just listening today, thinking, well, you know, I can identify that I get really anxious when I send a text and I'm waiting for someone to answer that text. And then I think, are we okay? And then I'm blowing up their phone with text. Are we okay? Did I do something wrong? One thing you can do is you can think about an experience with that person that you're texting while you're waiting for that text to come back. You can think about a positive experience with them and sit with that feeling inside of you and then go, I'm going to make it just an inch larger inside of me. And that can then begin to heal what we call anxious attachment. That would be an anxious attachment.
I know that you've mentioned the anxious attachment, but are there different kinds outside of that? I know for me, I am fully self-diagnosed anxious attachment. And so that definitely resonates with me. But the fact that there's, I feel like different kinds, you have to know what kind you have before you can start to really form like a healthy attachment.
It does help. I will say though, an interesting piece of attachment work is that you can have different attachment styles with different people.
Oh, interesting. I know. That makes sense though.
Right?
Yep.
Right? When Gabe and Shayna.
Shaney.
You're so close. Yeah.
Shaney, when y'all walked up and I didn't see y'all with Wendy, I don't have a secure attachment with you. My first question was, is Wendy coming? Right? Because you're in my secure attachment. We have a history together. And so it's recognizing with some people we don't feel safe, might be new people that we meet, but it can be people in your family. You show up at Christmas, you want to sit by this person because this person makes you feel uncomfortable. But it is important to know, because with the people that you want to have what we call secure attachment. And I'd like to talk a moment how secure attachment is formed. Is that okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
So sure. Secure attachment is eye contact with a baby.
Mm.
When you're holding that baby and you're looking down at that baby, it actually releases oxytocin in the brain. And oxytocin is that love hormone that when you start dating someone, you can't wait to hear from them, that releases in the brain of a baby. And so eye contact is very important. Another secure attachment trait is when that baby cries, you don't think that baby's spoiled. You think that baby has a need. Something's happening with the baby. It could just be they're lonely. Mm-hmm. They could have a wet diaper or a diaper that needs changing that has poop in it. It might be that they're hungry. My daughter will say, that's his hungry cry, right? You just begin to get attuned. When they fall down and they look to you, am I okay?
Yep.
You nod, you're okay. They're looking to their secure base. How am I doing? Or if they scrape their knee and they cry, that it's not, that what it is you go over and you comfort that child. And comfort is so important.
One of my first memories, actually, with my daughter is the moment after she was born, she was crying, like, you know, good loud cries.
Right.
The minute I held her and looked at her eyes, we made eye contact. And there was, she just stopped crying.
I feel the oxytocin listening to you talk about that. Yeah.
And she just, there was a sense of peace and, and it was, I could tell that bond right there was like instant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And these babies will grow up to trust people. These babies will grow up to go, you know what? I can meet my own needs, but I can also ask for help. It's not needy to ask for help.
Yeah.
They'll grow up going into a job interview, knowing, you know what? I can calm myself. I can regulate myself I'll breathe in the car before I walk in to go into this job interview. And they will pick relationships that don't have this dissonance with them. And I mean, intimate relationships where they go, oh, wait, they're not treating me the way I know I need to be treated. So they won't stay in that relationship. They know that they're valuable. They know that they're lovable. They know that they're worthy.
So what happens if maybe you're not that lucky and you didn't have that kind of upbringing? What's the prognosis? What kind of things are we looking at? What are those types of attachment that we might form?
Well, one of them is the anxious attachment. And if you grew up in a home where you could not predict when mom or dad was going to love you, you just thought there were times you went to mom or dad and you got some love and you got some care. You did what we call a bid for connection, and that bid for connection was met. But then there were other times you went to mom or dad and they ignored, they were busy on their computer, they were engrossed in a TV show, and it happened more than once. It happened over and over again. And so you couldn't predict. So what happens in your adult relationships is you get what would feel that are we okay feeling. Mm-hmm. And you get it because you go, I don't know when I'm going to get my love again. I don't know when I'm going to get this sense again. And so I'm going to seek after it to make sure I have it.
Mm-hmm. So like a vacuum.
It is. It is like a vacuum, and it can be like a black hole to the person with whom you're in relationship. Now, if you're in relationship with someone like that, one thing you can do that will help that person is you can look at them and say, I'm not going anywhere. Mm. I'm in this to win it. And if you say that enough times, it begins to calm them down so that they're not always anxious then when they don't get that text. So it's a beautiful piece of a relationship to realize, you know what, I am in a relationship with someone who has that anxious attachment. Hey, I can let them know. I can reassure them mm-hmm. that we're going to be okay.
It almost seems like that would be great to talk about when you have a couple and you're thinking about getting married, understanding each other, understanding your childhood and how you grew up, because it can be so different from your partner and what you consider normal, or you're getting that positive feedback might be very different from your partner.
Absolutely. It's like cultures that collide.
Okay.
And I do a lot of couples work. I love couples work. And it is true. We go back to childhood. Go back to childhood even with individual work. But we need to, because it's so important to connect the dots of why I am the way I am in the present.
Oh, I like that. Say that again.
We need to connect the dots to why I am who I am in the present. It's so important. And I love it in the counseling room when people connect those dots. Or even people who are listening today, if they're able to connect those dots and go, oh my word, I feel lonely all the time. And I heard stories of me being left in the crib to cry when I was a baby. That could be connected to the loneliness I'm feeling today. What can I do for that? I mean, inner child work is so important. And for the people listening, inner child just means we all have this, what I call inner child in us, that I want. When I go to the parks and when I go fly a kite, I want my inner child to come out and go, wee, right? But we also have this woundedness inside of us. And that baby that was left in the crib to cry, who didn't get the comfort that they needed, a way to heal that is to begin to talk to that baby inside of you. Now, sounds odd, but I'm not asking anybody to do something I haven't done myself. And what it sounds like is this. I'm thinking about that baby in the crib, and it breaks my heart to think that I was left in that crib to cry. And I'm just going to imagine that baby right here, and I'm going to love on that baby and say, I love you. And it hurts me that you were left in that crib to cry. I'm not going to leave you to cry anymore. Mm. And that way you do some of your own work and find some healing.
I like that, and that's something you can do pretty much anywhere you're at.
Anywhere. You can say, how old do I feel in this moment? I feel like I'm 3. Okay, I'm just going to tend to that 3-year-old that's showing up in this moment feeling stressed.
Well, it's super cool that you mentioned that, because I was going to bring up the fact that, you know, when I've done inner child work in the past, we've always tried to reflect on what is this, the baby wound, the toddler wound, the teenage wound, what part of me is seeking that connection, that confidence, that security. And it's super cool as well, the fact that, you know, we can communicate as much as we want, like, this is my attachment style, this is what I'm feeling, but unless it's comprehended by the other party and met halfway, it's just throwing words at each other until something sticks. So, you know, that what you talked about with the partner being like, okay, well, I can do this to meet you halfway on that attachment style is really cool and applicable to a lot of situations I find, not just with partners, but friends, parents. You know, healing that inner child wound in myself has helped my relationship with my mom greatly.
Right. Mm. Right. And most people in relationship want to know how to make this relationship better. Very few people will say, oh, you've told me I need to say, hey, we're going to make it. I'm not going anywhere, and don't do it. They just need a map quest. They need a map. They need something that gives them some help, something practical to help them to know how to interact in this relationship until everyone's at that secure attachment in that relationship. It's important to know what you need and to know what your partner needs. And sometimes I need to ask for what I need, and sometimes I hope you'll give it to me even if I don't ask.
Mm. Let's maybe go on to our next attachment style. What's the next one?
The next one is called avoidant or dismissive. And avoidance sounds exactly like what it is. They tend to isolate. They tend to go deep inside themselves. they were children who were brought up, and maybe people listening will say, well, I was brought up in a home like this, where when they made those bids for connection, they consistently were not met. And so they learned to go, you know what? My needs are not going to get met here. I got to figure out how to do this on my own. I got to figure out how to make sure I'm okay, get myself up and get dressed for school. I'm going to make sure my teeth are brushed. I'm going to make sure my homework is done. And they don't ask for help. They don't know how to ask for help. They don't feel like it's safe to ask for help, because when they asked for help growing up, they didn't get the help that they were looking for. And, you know, it can break the heart of a child to realize that the person who's supposed to be there for them, yeah, the person who's supposed to be their protector and supposed to love them unconditionally, is not giving them what they need. And so many times you'll have adults who are heartbroken over that, and it's about healing that broken heart. And one thing that I think is important for people who see themselves as that avoidant or dismissive is to practice asking for help. And start with someone you don't know. Like, you go to Publix, or I'm not endorsing Publix, but a grocery store, right? You go to a grocery store and you go to the produce department and you say, I'm looking for an avocado. Can you point me in the right direction? Because that worker doesn't care about you.
They're avocados are safe.
They're
safe. It's a good start.
And so healthy too.
Yes. Win-win.
Right. And so you begin practicing asking for help. And then you start with people in your life where you might say, I'm not good at asking for help. And they'll say, we know. We've tried. So I'm going to start practicing asking for help. And could you come alongside me and help me when I ask for help? Can you do what it is I'm asking you to do? Or, you know, point me in the right direction. And that will give a little bit more confidence in asking for help.
Yeah, I was going to say, are there patterns to the way attachment styles are drawn to each other? Are there trends?
I don't know the answer to that question. It's probably a very good question, though I will say in my experience, I have seen the anxious avoidant, anxious attachment and the avoidant do show up together, and it can be very what you were drawn to when you first started dating. Mm. It can be very disappointing in the end. I will say also that the avoidant attachment, one thing you need to do for them, if you're in relationship with someone who just pulls inside themselves and you feel like they're really deep down, if y'all are planning on going somewhere, you want to say to them, hey, in about 30 minutes, we're going to leave. Because and Diane Poole Heller, who I love, and she does a lot on attachment, but she talks about how it's like they're way underwater. And so if you say, hey, we're leaving, come on, let's go. It's like the pokey little puppy. They're like very slow to get out the door. But if you give them a heads up for that, or for a conversation that you want to have, you just need to give them a heads up so they don't get the bends when they come to the top. Mm. So it's real important for, if you're in relationship with an avoidant, to give them some time so they can recalibrate and be present with you.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And then we have something called disorganized attachment. And the disorganized attachment, really, they were brought up in threat. And so if they were at the playground playing and, you know, the secure attachment mom, if they see their child fall down, they're going to look to see if they're okay. They're going to attend to them if they need help. The avoidant mom may go over and help that child, or she may be so busy in conversation with her friends that she doesn't even notice that child has fallen. But the person who's brought up and disorganized, they'll be accused of doing something bad. I told you not to get at the top of that ladder, or I told you, what's wrong with you, type stuff. It doesn't always have to be physical abuse, so that is a part of it. But they are in survival mode in any relationship that they're in. They're always looking for, am I okay, or do I need to come in fighting? Do I need to people please? What do I need to do? And they're not really great in relationships until they can get some healing. They might go from relationship to relationship.
Interesting. Okay, so we've got avoidant, we have disorganized, we have anxious, we have a fourth.
Secure.
Secure.
Yeah, that's the secure.
And that's where we want to be.
That is what we want to work for, absolutely. And even inside yourself, develop a secure attachment with yourself, which is so important. And that is, if you talk critically to yourself, Number one, the research shows that raises anxiety. So if you struggle with anxiety out there and you notice your self-talk is critical, that's one way to help yourself to even be less anxious. But most people who were brought up with these attachment styles were brought up with some criticism. And the criticism then gets internalized and actually shows up to protect you. Mm-hmm. Now, that just means if I say to myself, I'm so stupid, before you say it to me, then I'm prepared for what you're going to say to me. Mm. And so to help yourself develop that relationship with yourself is to be able to say, that was really a stupid thing to do, but I'm going to love myself. I'm going to accept myself. I'm going to go, I'm human, and it is okay to be human. So it's really important to work on noticing when you're even anxious within yourself.
What about, you know, I'm thinking I'm a mom. Teenage kids, you know, they don't want to talk to you. The more you push, the more go the way. And you're like, what has happened to my beautiful little girl or my little boy? They're shut off from me completely. I don't know how to reach them. I know something is going on, but I don't even know where to begin or how to get them to talk to me. Did I do everything right as a parent when my attachment style? Maybe I know I didn't back then. What would be the first steps for a parent in that type of situation to take?
Well, I think there's two first steps that I think about is teens normally move toward their peers as that's a natural progression and something we need to celebrate that they're moving toward their peers. But if as you're listening, you think to yourself, I was on my phone a lot. I wasn't attentive or I was there and then I wasn't.
Or maybe I'm a single mom and I couldn't be there. And, you know, that is another issue where you have guilt probably or, you know, mm-hmm. those types of issues. But let's just say you weren't. Then what do you do?
Well, the first thing that I would suggest that anyone do is go and speak with that child and take responsibility for where you see you've failed them. That builds so much respect in a child for a parent. If a parent is able to say, you know, I heard this podcast and I realized that there were times in your life that I just wasn't attentive to you. There were times you cried out to me and I was too busy, even unintentionally, because hurts can come under unintentional hurts, intentional hurts, and beyond our control hurts. Being a single mom working two jobs is beyond your control. But my belief on hurts is no matter how a hurt happens, it's important that we process them through. It's like if I dropped a bowling ball on your foot, Wendy, and if I dropped it unintentionally, intentionally, or it was beyond my control, when we take you to urgent care, are they going to ask?
No.
They're going to treat that broken foot the same way. And we need to see that if we say, well, I didn't mean to, so then you should be over it. That won't go very far with a child or a partner. But instead, if you go to that teenager and able to, maybe even at night, you know, when everything's kind of settled down, and you say, I just realized I've made some mistakes as you were growing up, and I want to say it probably made you feel even betrayed by me, and it's good to step into the feelings of what you feel like that person felt. You probably felt rejected by me. I'm just sure I hurt you. Probably at times you felt alone and you felt discouraged by the way I was parenting you. And I just want to admit that I was wrong and ask you, will you forgive me?
That's powerful.
It's powerful. I'm sorry has a period. And we walk away going, okay, we're good because I said I'm sorry. Will you forgive me has a question mark. And expect your teen. Maybe they'll say yes, we hope so. And I always say a hug is good after that. They could say no, which will break your heart. But then you might want to say, is there anything I can do to repair this between us? To change that no to a yes. Or they may say, I really want to, but I need more from you than what you're giving me. And then you make a plan of how to be active in that child's life, in that teen's life. And it might be they play sports and you've not been able to attend games and you work on getting your schedule where you can come to some of those games and have the t-shirt with the name on it and be the parent that's obnoxious.
It's never too late.
It is never too late. See, there's this beautiful thing called neuroplasticity. You ever heard that term?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I heard it like 2 years ago. Like, where have I been? And I love it. And that's just the brain's capacity to heal. And we want to heal. It's in our DNA to be in relationship. That teen who's isolated themselves, anybody who's isolated themselves, we're not wired that way. We're wired for connection. But repair, Dr. Alan Shore, he talks about when you have rupture with repair, it's better to have rupture with repair than to have no rupture at all. Ruptures happen, but if you repair it, it actually makes a child's brain more resilient in the future. So you can't. It's time to stop feeling guilty about the ruptures. Instead, find out how to do that repair. And those steps I just gave you are steps I use in my own life and with the people around me. They know these steps.
Now, what if you're in a family where maybe you're adopted, or you've had a past when you were very young that has changed and your family has changed? I know my background is I worked in foster care for many years. And Gabe, you brought up a term called reactive attachment disorder. Sandra, could you walk us through what that term is?
I do not know much about reactive disorder. I would prefer to give that over to Gabe because that is not,
yeah.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
So that's a diagnosis I would see in a lot of the patients in the places I've worked, group homes, residential programs, especially if there was no bonds formed.
Yeah.
So a lot of those like adopted babies that, came from orphanages or whatnot. And those individuals had a hard time forming bonds. And so you could tell when they would make friendships, they would just explode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was difficult to manage, and it was hard to
so you start to see those behaviors coming out.
Correct.
Because you probably don't know how to maybe express the feelings, or you've never had the positive relationships formed.
And from what I could see, those bonds were scary.
Mm.
So once someone getting close, it was hard for that patient to, connect with, friends, staff, things like that.
Isn't it amazing how important it is those first few years? The developmental.
Definitely. I was in a training yesterday, and I wanted to bring this up just because a lot of my passion and work that I do is with addiction and substance use, like some of our services are as well. And one of the things was about attachment style and the reason why the addicted brain, like neurologically, can't say no is because it seeks this attachment with the substance, because it doesn't have that secure attachment with anything else or anyone else. It says,
soothing.
And it was like, if I want to use, I can. If I want to have this feeling, I can. It's my actions, that same self-sufficient. What attachment style was it? Where it's the more...
is it the anxious?
No, where they don't ask for help.
Oh, yeah.
Avoidant.
Thank you. Where it's like people with more avoidant, more anxious attachment style, they can get that instant gratification from substances and from knowing exactly what's going to happen when they use that exact substance, that even though it's uncomfortable and unmanageable, it's expected.
Right. And the avoidant attachment also gets their nourishment from work, maybe from the drugs coming up, right? And food is one that... Food has a nurturing feel to it. So turning to food to get that nurturing that maybe someone didn't get growing up.
That makes
up.
A lot of sense, too.
And so part of it is learning, how then do I get nourishment from relationships? How can I take this nourishment I'm getting from this drug, from this food, from working, becoming a workaholic? How can I then say, wait a minute, I'm going to figure out how can I get to know the person in front of me and let that fill my soul the same way that these other things have.
That's awesome. Yeah, it was definitely interesting to read about yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked a little bit about the four attachment types. We talked a little bit about what that looks like if you've experienced those as a young child. We talked a little bit about relationships and how that can affect us. You said you work a lot with couples and you have a private practice. So if someone were to come into your office and you're seeing some of these things, what are some of the tips that you would give those individuals?
Well, really some of the same things that I've said here is one is to educate them on what the attachment styles are,
mm-hmm.
and helping them to even identify where they are. And some come in with a secure attachment, but they may still be in a relationship with an anxious attachment. So it's about teaching those words of, I'm not going anywhere, I'm here, because there's that sense of, are you going to abandon me? Are we going to be okay? And I have a friend who will text me and say, are we okay? And so I'm like, we're good, we're fine. I missed your last text, you know, I didn't notice it. So it would be that. It would be saying, give them some time before you need to talk with them or before you're going to leave for out to do something. Encourage them to ask you for help. And, you know, the dishwasher can be loaded in so many different ways, right?
Yep.
So it's about, instead of wanting it done just a certain way, receiving that help to say, it's not exactly how I would do it, but I'm going to be grateful and I'm going to go, that's some help that needs to be received. And a huge one, too, is just saying thank you when people help you. To say, if I said, Gabe, you look so nice today, and Gabe said, this old thing, it's been hanging in the closet, right? That's not receiving my compliment. Mm. And so practicing even gratitude will help to open up your heart and be vulnerable toward one another.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think also I would mention that some strategies that come up for people who are brought up in these types of homes, it's not secure attachment, it's people pleasing. So if you go, oh my word, I'm a people pleaser, I can't say no to anybody, it just comes from that sense of, I need to please my parent to get that love. And learning how to set those boundaries, and that again comes to that self-love. Or believe it or not, in some homes, kids will not say they're in pain because that parent, the avoidant parent, doesn't know how to handle that pain. So maybe they have appendicitis, they won't say till the last minute because that parent doesn't know how to handle it. And they begin to protect that parent. Mm-hmm. So you get into then your adult relationships and you don't want to express joy, you don't want to express sorrow because you don't know if it's safe to do so, and it can cause issues. Mm-hmm. So it's about setting people up for success. And part of that setting people up is to let people, if I said to you, Gabe, I'm about to tell you how much I love my husband, and I need you to say to me, Sandra, I'm so happy you love your husband so much. I'm giving him that direction that, because I want him to respond a certain way, and it is okay to do that. As mm-hmm. people are learning how to be in relationship, it's a great way to say, really, why I haven't shared my emotions, because people don't know how to handle them. They don't know what to do with them. So I might say, you know, I'm very upset and I need you to hold me. That's okay.
Yeah.
And that's a step toward healing.
It seems to me, from what you're saying, being vulnerable and taking a chance to allow yourself to be vulnerable in front of people.
It is, and that is not a cuss word.
Vulnerability is strength. I always try to remind people that, you know, especially when they're thinking about taking a big step for their own health, mental health, physical health, substance use, that like vulnerability is the strongest thing you can do. It doesn't mean weakness.
It actually absolutely is. And I'll tell my clients that the root word for courage, like when we think of courage, I think of the knight in shining armor on the white horse coming to slay the dragon, certainly a courageous act. But really the root word of courage is to open up one's heart.
Yes.
I got that from Dr. Brené Brown. I'll give her the credits in her book, The Gifts of Imperfection. But it's so true. Gosh, it takes a lot of courage to trust you with my heart. And yet, that's the very thing I want to do. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to trust you with my heart.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's the scariest thing, is to be able to do that. But once you do and you get it out there, well, I mean, what's the worst that could happen?
The worst that can happen, they find a new relationship. I get a good counselor. I don't know.
Yes, yes. You call Sandra.
That's a hard question to answer.
Yeah, exactly. But it's taking the chance. And it's like we talked about a little earlier before the podcast, jumping off the cliff. You know, you're at the edge and it seems really scary, but you've got that parachute on.
Got that parachute on.
And it probably gets a little easier the next time you do it.
It absolutely does get easier the next time you do it, because as you see success and you set yourself up for success to get what you need, then you're able then to go, well, I can do that again. And then you learn how to be in that relationship. And it's that becomes give and take instead of either give, give, give or take, take, take. And I think one other point I'd like to make is that I'll do my hand across, when you grow up in a chaotic home environment, and this is peace, those children and then adults don't know what to do with peace, because when they had peace at home, they were waiting for that next shoe to drop. And so they will create drama. They will create chaos because chaos feels safe to them. And so if the people listening go, oh, my word, it's true. When I go out to eat dinner with my husband and we're having a good time, and then I bring up the finances, I pick a fight, I talk about his mother, I do, and this peaceful time then goes to an argument and we go home mad at each other. Start to notice if you do that, or if your spouse or partner or friend does that. And the way that you heal that or begin to heal that is to recognize that peace is what is truly safe in a healthy relationship. And so when you're feeling peace and you start to pick that fight, you want to catch yourself and even say to whoever you're going to pick that fight with, I'm about to pick a fight with you because I'm feeling anxious about this peace I'm experiencing. Can we sit a little bit longer in this peace and then I'll pick my fight with you, right? So you want to stretch your window of tolerance for peace, and you want to remind your nervous system, peace is safe. Chaos is not. Yeah.
Sounds like healing is a lot of, biological healing too, because between the neuroplasticity we talked about and our parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems, we're essentially rewiring our brain while trying to heal.
Yeah, Sandra, earlier you were talking a little bit about that, about calming yourself down for an interview. Do you have any other techniques that are simple that our listeners could probably apply?
I have a few. I do. Thank you for asking. One is really simple. It's by Deb Dana. And it's where you imagine someone that you love, and they can be even imaginary someone that you just think, if I could just be their friend, and you want to imagine their hand on the small of your back. Like I always imagine my husband's hand on my back as we're walking through a crowd and he puts his hand there. So you can just imagine someone you love to put their hand right there on your back. That will actually calm your nervous system, take you out of fight, flight, freeze, and you'll be able to engage. And then there's something called the four elements. Are y'all familiar with the four elements?
Love it. No, I'm not either. I want to know.
Oh, my goodness.
I love them. They're good on the back of my business card because they're just so beautiful. The first one is earth. And so many times when we're anxious, when something, we're that what if, and we just, it's really future thinking. And earth brings you right back into the present. And what you would do is you will put both feet on the ground and you will feel the ground beneath your feet. And then you're going to look around the room and you're going to say, I see four things around the room that are black. And you pick out those four black things. Also, one thing I do with my feet on the ground is I push my heels into the earth and point my toes up. I don't know why we do things in threes, but I do that three times. And then I've got my things in the room and all of a sudden I'm like, you know what? I'm not at that job interview tomorrow. I'm right here in this room preparing for this job interview and I can breathe a little bit. The second one is air, which is breathing. And my tip on breathing is to think of a cool color. And for me, it's jade green. And a hot color is red. You can pick your own. Whoever's listening, just feel free to pick your own color. And when you breathe in, I'm going to breathe in that jade green. I'm going to breathe out that red. So I would breathe in and then out through my mouth. And that would be the red coming out. And I do that three times. And then the next one's water. And I love this one because when we're anxious, our mouth goes dry. And when our mouth goes dry, our brain goes, ooh, we're in danger. Stomach, you need to stop digesting. So if you can create saliva and you think about biting into a lemon or a sunburst or something, you know, really sour, and you create that saliva, your brain goes, okay, calm down, everybody, calm down. Like an Inside Out, that movie, or calm down. And your stomach will start digesting again and take you back to the parasympathetic and your nervous system. And then you're able to calm down. And so the last element is fire. And fire, I'm an EMDR therapist. And so we use the calm, safe place with that. And so fire is just an imaginary place. For me, it's a cabin in the mountains. And I imagine myself on this wraparound porch. And I have my Bible and I've got my coffee. And I can smell my creamer and see the mountains and hear the brook. And That's fire. That's just that. And I go there and I'm good. So that's the four elements.
Oh, I like that. Sounds and peaceful. So descriptive. I know. Mm-hmm. Gabe, what's yours? If you had to pick your earth.
My earth? I guess for grounding.
like your safe space. Hers is her mountain
fire.
Home.
Yeah.
Oh, your fire.
Yeah.
Definitely for me, where I like to go in my mind is I love kayaking in the springs. And it's just, for me, it's paradise.
Yeah.
It's paradise. Just that, especially the springs I go to with the clear blue water, and you're just surrounded totally by nature.
Yes.
No signals, no.
Yes.
And that's just gliding through the water. And then a lot of times we see manatee, dolphin where we go. So.
Oh, I love that. What about you, Shaney?
I actually had a conversation about this last week about where we go when we're feeling like out of our body, that feeling of like stress and anxiety and oh my God. And for me, I used to go to this park as a kid with my mom and my sister. We'd go every Saturday, had a blanket with like board games, and there was people all around. So I try to put myself in that spot of like, you know, I am just one person and there are people around me experiencing their lives, but it's like the trees blowing and the sun and the like the clouds all around. And so I love going there and anytime
that's beautiful.
I can.
It's really pretty.
Where would yours be?
Yeah. Oh, I got a special one that I used to. So it's this memory I have when I was probably about 5 years old and we were going to cut down a Christmas tree with my mom, my dad, and me. And I remember just running around the trees and hearing the snow crunch under my feet. Wow. And just feeling like blissfully happy in a way that only a child could.
It's beautiful.
Sounds like the dream.
Yeah.
It does. Yeah. And the wonderful thing about the brain, and there's so many wonderful things about the brain, is that when you talk about that kayak and you put yourself there and you're seeing those manatees, your brain will say, I'm in a kayak looking at manatees. And that's why it can have that capacity to calm you down, because your brain goes, I'm not over there. I'm over here. I'm in North Carolina looking at the Christmas tree farm on the front porch with my coffee and my
perspective.
What the brain believes the body responds to.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful statement. What the brain.
Like that.
Will you say that again?
Yes.
What the brain believes the body responds to.
That's a great closer.
Truth. Yeah.
I like that.
I do too.
Therapist told me that one. I can't take credit.
Well, I love that.
Me too.
Perfect. Well, thanks for listening today. And how can someone find out more about attachment styles and get more information if they're interested?
I would say Diane Poole Heller she's the best in my book. I've learned so much from her. You can go on Amazon and buy her book, The Power of Connection. I love that book because it not only talks about attachment styles, it has exercises in there to help heal an attachment style. It has a quiz to help you identify your attachment style. That's where I got the exercise for Grow It an Inch, because it came from her book. And that's the main person that I go to. There is also the Yurkoviches do some work on attachment styles for couples, and they have a book and a workbook on Amazon as well, if you wanted to work through your own workbook, that would help you. They don't call them these exact styles that I talked about, but it is the same premise.
Perfect. Well, thank you. If you want to get in touch with Sandra Stanford, she has a mental health private practice in Titusville, Florida. If you're interested in any of our full continuum of care for mental health and substance use, you can reach out to any of our four facilities, Palm Point University Behavioral Center, Central Florida Behavioral Hospital, and La Mostad. Thank you so much for joining us today, listeners. We hope to see you next time, and thanks to our co-hosts as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.